the matter of Robert Sipko versus Coger. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Chief Justice Michael Stein, Pashman Stein, Walter Hayden, on behalf of the petitioner, a happy new year to all. And Chief Justice, I do feel duty bound to very quickly acknowledge the empty chair and express, I'm sure on behalf of everybody, gratitude and appreciation for the more than 20 years of wonderful service of Justice LaVecchia.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. And I'm gonna assume that all counsel are gonna make a similar comment and we're incorporating it. Mr. Reiser.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning and happy new year again. Scott Reiser with Lum, Drasko and Positan on behalf of the respondent Coger Inc.
Good morning, Your Honor. Joseph LaSalla, McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney, and Carpenter. Happy New Year, everyone. Also on behalf of respondent Rastislav Sitko.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Stein, please go ahead.
May it please the court. The question to be considered on this petition is whether, under the circumstances presented, a remand is required to reconsider the valuation of KPS and KDS. The answer to that question is informed considerably, I believe, by two legal principles. First, on the scope of appellate review of judgments in non-jury cases, this court reaffirmed in Balsamides the particular deference due a trial judge in valuation disputes, offering the following observation, and I quote, "Experts exercise judgment at many stages in the valuation process. As a result, their credibility and reliability are critical. Only the trial court has the opportunity to see, hear, and question the expert witness. Additionally, the trial court's findings on valuation typically are only one aspect of the overall resolution of the matter. Appellate courts should take care in accepting some and rejecting other findings of the court, as they may disturb the logic and equitable balance of the trial court's other conclusions. Accordingly, great deference is due with trial court's finding." That standard has particular pertinence here. First, Chancery Judge Robert Cantillo, now retired, presided over this matter for a decade, from the filing of the complaint in 07 through the 6-day trial in 08, during the entirety of the 3-year remand proceeding, culminating in his final remand decision in July 2016, and of course then during post-judgment proceedings. He was able to evaluate the credibility of the experts at trial, where each expert spent a full day on the stand, subject to cross-examination and extensive questioning from the court. He questioned our expert, Hubert Klein, at length on the question of how, if at all, George's control and KPS and KDS's dependence on Coger affected value. Questions to which Mr. Klein provided substantive responses. I refer you to transcript 3, 180 to 186. He was able to assess, for context, record evidence that in 06 and 07 alone, the first 2 years after Robert's separation, George and Ross received more than $17 million in salary, almost the same amount as the $18 million valuation of Robert's equity interests. He heard Mr. Klein explain his reliance on Balsamides and Lawson in determining that a discount was not appropriate. It was Judge Cantillo who struck from the record defendant's expert opinion that a discount should apply, supported as it was by nothing other than instructions from counsel. And he was there at the very first remand appearance where defendant's counsel declined an invitation to commission a new expert report, resting instead on the strategic decision to argue that Robert was entitled to nothing more than reinstatement as an owner of companies whose value had been stripped by the defendants. Judge Cantillo bore witness to the fact that not once during the remand proceeding did defendants challenge Mr. Hubert's valuation conclusions. Judge Cantillo was in the best position to conclude, as he did, that Mr. Hubert's expert opinion was coherent, convincing, and of course, unrebutted. A remand to another judge makes no sense. Now, the applicability of a marketability discount is, as noted by the appellate division, a question of law. And that brings me to the second legal principle I'd like to highlight. This court ended its analysis in Lawson with the following conclusion, and again, I quote, where the oppressing shareholder instigates the problem, fairness dictates that the oppressing shareholder should not benefit at the expense of the oppressed. The statute does not allow the oppressor to harm his partner and be rewarded with the right to buy out that partner at a discount. That legal principle begs two questions. Was Robert oppressed? And if not, should the principle expressed in Balsamides and Lawson apply to those who engage in fraud but not oppression? It is true that this court's 2013 remand decision left undisturbed the finding of no oppression. But then there was a three-year remand proceeding completely ignored by the appellate division, which irrefutably revealed that from the filing of the complaint to the present, defendants have acted fraudulently in a singular effort to thwart Robert from obtaining fair compensation for his equity interests, first by fraudulently backdating stock transfer certificates, and then by continuously diverting tens of millions of dollars from KPS and KDS, rendering them valueless. Judge Cantillo did not use the word oppression to describe defendant's conduct in his remand decision, but if that conduct is not oppression, I don't know what is. And regardless, we don't need a remand for this court to make clear that the conduct was at the least fraudulent, and that as a matter of law, equity, and fairness, defendants are not entitled to the benefit of a marketability discount. 15 seconds, if I might, more. One final point. On top of everything else, there's the matter of George's and Ross's unprecedented, contemptuous post-judgment conduct. Equity cannot and should not abide that conduct. The remand should be vacated. Judge Cantillo's judgment and opinion should be affirmed in its entirety. That's the end of my opening remarks.
Mr. Stein, before you go forward, a question for you and just a reminder to counsel and colleagues to mute yourselves during the argument, except for when you're speaking. Mr. Stein, can you help us with a background question? If I remember correctly, there was some property that was posted and forfeited. Can you tell us what is the value
of property that is available today if a judgment were entered in your favor?
Yeah. So using approximate numbers, through today, we have collected approximately $19 million. And that includes properties that were forfeited pursuant to the February 13, 2017 order and then liquidated. There is approximately, including pre-judgment interest, about $7 million left to be collected, maybe a little bit more. And the only assets remaining in the U.S. are a home owned by Ross in Connecticut that was among the properties pledged and forfeited by the February 13 order, but remains out of reach because Ross consented to a prejudgment attachment in a divorce proceeding ongoing in Connecticut, in which we are interveners. So that property, which is now titled in Robert's name, we think it might, you know, it could be worth $4 or $5 million. And the question is, are we entitled to the entirety of that? Or does Ross's wife receive an equitable interest? She's been living it in the house with her children. That's the subject of a divorce proceeding. The only other property is a Merrill Lynch account. It was ordered turned over by Judge Cantillo, but then the next business day, Ross consented in Connecticut no one had knowledge of this in advance to a prejudgment attachment that's frozen that account. There's about $1 million in that account. Our best estimate is that even if we are completely successful in Connecticut, we will not obtain full satisfaction of the judgment based on assets in the U.S. Finally, Chief Justice, there are a few properties owned jointly by George and Ross in Slovakia. In Slovakia, you're not entitled to even attempt to execute on property until final judgment and all appeals have been exhausted. So that remains something in the wings.
Thank you.
In terms of my argument, number one, I just want to emphasize and talk a little more about the fact that, in our view, a remand is wholly unnecessary to decide the purely legal question of a marketability discount. And, you know, in footnote 17 of the appellate division decision, there's a suggestion that because the words oppression were not used in the remand decision, and maybe even a suggestion that because the finding of no oppression was left undisturbed in this court's 2013 opinion, that Balsamides and Lawson don't apply. And to that, I just want to say a couple of things. Number one, I think the remand decision describes oppression. I mean, I can't think of more oppressive conduct than diverting all the revenues, rendering companies valueless that Robert had a 50% interest in. They're certainly fraudulent. But to the extent this court disagrees and doesn't find that to be oppressive conduct, I think it's important to let the bar know whether this conduct, whatever words are used to describe it, fall within the ambit of the conclusions reached and the holding set forth in the Balsamides and Lawson case. But I also think this is important. You know, both Balsamides and Lawson, the courts there wrestled with the equities. And of course, fairness and equity is at the foundation. But in both those cases, what was anticipated, you know, in Balsamides, the oppressor was the seller, and it was the opposite in Lawson. But in both cases, the court grappled with the fact that after the buyout, there was an existing company that one day would be sold and perhaps subject to the burden of a less than fair market value price because of marketability issues. That's not the case here. What we had here and what the court well knew going into the remand was the companies that Robert was ordered equitably bought out of were empty shells. There was never going to be a situation where George and Ross were going to turn around and sell these companies and be burdened by a marketability discount because they stripped the companies of all their value. And that was a very significant component of what the court had to wrestle with in Balsamides and Lawson. It doesn't apply here, which underscores the equities and fairness of this case and the rightness of Judge Contillo's determination to accept Hubert Klein's expert opinion, including no marketability discount. But as a matter of policy, this court should make clear that illegality and fraud, like oppression, can make a bad actor not eligible for the marketability discount. The next point I want to make is this. The appellate division...
Mr. Stein, can I ask you a question just about marketability discount? Is that factor available because it somehow describes what value a practice or property a company has on the market itself? I know it's called a discount, but when you're trying to value a company, is this marketability discount just another way of saying that's the way you value the company? Are you following me? I'm trying to understand what this marketability discount actually means.
Well, look, I think that's right. I think the marketability discount is an attempt to grapple with the fact that closely held companies might have a smaller market. But appraisers throughout our state have, you know, since 1999, have read Balsamides and Lawson to say that absent extraordinary circumstances, there's no cut and dried rule, but generally when assessing equity and fairness, the oppressor ought not get the benefit of a discount so as not to incentivize oppressive conduct. So
I understand that. I'm just trying to understand the concept, whether or not even the concept of discount is a misnomer. Or am I mistaken a bit? Is it a discount if that's the way you're supposed to actually determine the value of the company. You following me?
I'm not sure, but that may get to the difference between fair market value and fair value, the latter of which has an equitable component injected into it. But I'm not positive I'm answering your question satisfactorily, and for that, I apologize. The next point I want to make is the active remand part of the decision feels a bit like a gotcha, and I just want to explain why. On remand, defendants made a strategic decision. I mean, we all know it. We were there for 3 years to decline the invitation on the very first day of remand. I remember it like it was yesterday. And Judge Contillo said, you know, do we need to reopen the record? I mean, mindful that this court had said twice in its opinion an unrebutted expert report. And he questioned the Lum firm on you know, you don't want it, you don't need a new expert. And they said no. And not only did they decline that invitation, but they never challenged the sufficiency of our expert's conclusions or his testimony during the three-year remand decision period. Instead, they went all in on their strategic decision and their argument that we weren't entitled to a buyout because there was no oppression, and that the only remedy available to us was reinstatement as an owner of valueless companies. That was a strategic decision that they made. And so the question of the sufficiency of Hubert Klein's unrebutted opinion was just not a part of the remand decision. And it's no wonder, therefore, that Judge Contillo was rather succinct in his embracing of that opinion. And I think that it's an important point because, you know, we in the court below spent 3 years and millions of dollars in attorney's fees in reliance on that strategic decision and on the positions that defendants took down below. And it wasn't until the appeal that they raised these issues. I also want to touch just briefly on the impact I think that the post-judgment conduct should have on this. And the instructions on remand were for the trial court to exercise its broad equitable powers to fashion a remedy that suited the underlying circumstances. And that's precisely what Judge Contillo did. So we're talking about an equitable remedy here, an equitable buyout, and defendants' hands are not just dirty, they're the dirtiest hands I've ever seen coming into an argument before the Supreme Court. They're filthy, and they nonetheless were provided substantive relief on a discretionary, equitable decision resting on the credibility of expert witnesses who testified nearly 15 years ago before a now retired judge. Equity and the interests of justice, I would argue, should not abide a remand. The last couple things that I'd like to touch on is the criticisms, if you can call them that, of the appellate division. I think they were centered on the marketability discount, which it's a legal question, and there's no need for a remand for this court to either affirm Judge Contillo's decision or explain why a marketability discount is appropriate. But they raised two other issues. They claim that Mr. Klein did not account for the fact that KPS and KDS were dependent on Cozier infrastructure and dominated by George. That's just not so. There was a long colloquy between the court and Hubert Klein, and it's at T3, transcript number 3, pages 180 to 186, where at the original trial, Judge Contillo was bothered by what he thought was this interdependence. In fact, because he was so bothered by it, first go round, he found no value, but Hubert Klein gave substantive responses. Then he said, hey, look, basically, you got these contracts in KP's names, you got these revenue streams, and, you know, we're valuing the company based on capitalization of earnings, based on the value as of a date certain. It would be inappropriate to take into account something that might or might not happen down the road. So there was a substantive answer to that I don't think was appreciated by the appellate division. And finally, the appellate division seemed bothered by the fact that there was a lack of knowledge about the underlying licensing agreements that gave rise to the great revenue streams, in particular to KPS. But 2 points on that. Number one, neither expert relied on those licensing contracts in their capitalization of earnings approach or in their market approach to valuation. And number two, what the court didn't appreciate is that we had spent years and countless motions and countless requests trying to get information, financial information from defendants, including these licensing agreements. And it was not until the eve of trial, after expert reports had been circulated, the very end of November with a December 8 beginning of trial date, that we got those licensing agreements. And at that point, the reports had already been done, the conclusions had been reached. And that, it's galling to me that defendants didn't raise that issue on remand, raised it on appeal without acknowledging the efforts we had to go through and their conduct in blocking our efforts to obtain discovery. And in fact, we didn't get all the financial documents that we sought in the underlying case because they didn't provide everything. And
Mr. Stein, as you've already mentioned, Judge Cantillo offered defendants the ability to present their own expert on remand, and they didn't do so. So these arguments with regard to the criticisms of Klein's expert testimony could have been made by defendants if they chose to present their own expert, but chose not to do so, and continue to maintain that because there was no oppression, there was no remedy beyond dissolution of the companies.
Exactly. And I couldn't have said that better myself. Look, maybe in our briefing to the appellate division, we should have spent more time explaining the support in the record for all of the conclusions of Hubert Klein, like we've tried to do in this cert petition. But in our minds, these were issues that hadn't been raised below. They had chosen a course and a strategy. And, we thought that those issues were waived as Your Honor just articulated. I do think that as laid out on pages 18 to 19 of our petition, there's ample support in Judge Cantillo's original opinion and reconsideration opinion for his conclusion. But again, even if this court were to find that there were not, I think that it's well within the authority and power of this court to render a decision on the marketability discount, which makes a whole lot more sense than remanding to a new judge to do what? To go through the record, try to discern the credibility of witnesses of 15 years ago when this new judge didn't preside over the trial, to render a legal conclusion on marketability discount. A remand allows defendants an opportunity for more mischief. It's time to put an end to this case. Thank you very much. And I'd like to reserve a couple minutes. I didn't say that when I started my argument.
Questions? Anyone have any questions for Mr. Stein? We'll have you back briefly for rebuttal.
Mr. Reiser.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Coger asked this court to uphold that part of the appellate division's August 19th, 2020 decision, remanding the matter to the trial court for a new valuation hearing. Now, we've just heard from Mr. Stein about the marketability discount issue, but I'd submit to the court that the remand is broader than just whether the marketability discount should or should not apply. On page 41 of its decision, the appellate division held that by simply accepting Mr. Klein's expert opinions, which the trial court had implicitly rejected at trial, and this is the critical part, without any considered explanation for their acceptance on remand, the judge failed to reach a reasoned, just, factually supported conclusion by weighing and evaluating the expert's opinions, including their credibility. The appellate division panel found this to be problematic in light of the testimony of defendant's expert, Mr. Schmidt, which the panel found to have focused on the impact that Cozier's support, infrastructure, and goodwill had on the value that was attached to Cozier, KDS, and KPS. Mr. Klein, plaintiff's expert, admitted that he had no knowledge of the licensing agreements which existed between the Cozier entities. Furthermore, the appellate division found that Mr. Schmidt's testimony was in fact credited, at least to some degree, based on the trial court's conclusion that KPS and KDS had no independent value and were in fact totally dependent on Cozier. The appellate division noted that defendants had in fact justified a marketability discount despite not separately valuing each entity. Thus, under Balsamides, it would be appropriate to apply a marketability discount in a forced buyout in the absence of shareholder oppression. Because of that, the court, quote unquote, reluctantly remanded the matter for reconsideration of the value of plaintiff's interest in KPS and KDS as of the valuation date. That valuation date, of course, has never been in dispute in this matter. Now, this is a wide-ranging remand. In other words, a court did not simply remand the matter for entry of judgment along with a more detailed written decision. The court did not remand the matter to apply a marketability discount. And rather, the appellate division remanded the matter to the trial court and said that the court should consider all sources of information that affect the fairness and equity of Klein's suggested buyout price, including Schmidt's criticisms, the idiosyncratic relationship between the entities, and its effect on valuation. In other words, on remand, the trial court should address the testimony of Mr. Schmidt in 2008. The court also noted the trial court's ability to marshal additional proofs, if necessary, to determine a fair and equitable buyout remedy. Now, plaintiff in his petition for certification focuses on two primary issues. First, he improperly cabins the remand solely for the consideration of the marketability discount issue in this matter. And then plaintiff claims that the remand runs afoul of Balsamides and Lawson, Martin, Reed, because he claims that those cases require a trial court not to apply marketability discount to a buyout valuation where there is improper or inequitable conduct, which I would submit is not really addressed by those cases. Yet nothing in the appellate division's remand decision requires the trial court to apply a marketability discount. Rather, the remand expressly requires the trial court to consider all sources of information that affect the valuation. Presumably, that guidance would allow the trial court to consider whatever conduct plaintiff can show to have been unfair and thus to justify the lack of a marketability discount. Second, plaintiff asks this court to consider the post-remand judgment conduct of George and Raz, occurring 9 years or more after the valuation date, as bearing on the valuation of these entities as of the agreed upon valuation date of November 13th, 2007, which was the date of the filing of the complaint. While we in no way intend or attempt to minimize the seriousness of the alleged misconduct of George and Raz, the fact remains that the trial court, the appellate division, and this court have all weighed in on and imposed significant penalties for that conduct. George Sipko's appeals have been dismissed under the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. Raz has been incarcerated, and all of the defendants have been sanctioned following substantial motion practice in the trial court with regard to the post-judgment conduct. More directly, however, Cozier has never been found directly to have caused such acts. Rather, Cozier, as the only solvent entity, has been required to pay the sanctions awards. Finally, and I believe most importantly for this court today, all of the alleged misconduct has been addressed. In 2013, this court initially remanded the matter to the trial court for an assessment of what remedy, if any, should be applied in favor of plaintiff. After ordering an accounting, the trial court found that revenue had been improperly diverted from KPS and KDS to Cozier, both before and after the valuation date. Accordingly, because of that alleged improper diversion, KPS and KDS had no value. Had no value as of 2016, the trial court then found it to be proper to impose a remedy where Kosher, George, and Raz as well, but they fund the buyout price to plaintiff. Accordingly, the remedy was imposed based in part on the alleged misconduct from 2006 to 2009. The trial court issued a 12-page remand decision with 26 numbered paragraphs. 24 of those paragraphs addressed liability. In other words, the trial court carefully laid out its reasoning for finding that Robert was entitled to a buyout of his interest in KPS and KDS, and the specific mechanics for obtaining payment. In other words, through George, Kosher, and or Raz. Yet in the two paragraphs in which the trial court discussed the valuation, trial court simply found that because defendants purportedly had not put forth an approach to valuation which considered KPS and KDS independently, that their approach was not acceptable. That determination, however, improperly shifted the burden to defendants and more importantly, ignored the testimony of both trial experts. The conclusion, this is paragraph 25 of the remand decision, neatly opines that, quote unquote, Robert's value is not zero. No alternative but zero has been put forth by the defense. Unfortunately, and why we are before this court, is that the trial court didn't show its work on how it accepted plaintiff's valuation, the calculations it would have had to consider in order to reach the opinion that Mr. Klein's valuation was proper. Accordingly, remand is appropriate to correct those errors. Now, in summing up my opening statement, I'm just reminded of when I was beginning my career as a law clerk in general equity. And what sticks out to me is one of the first things that I learned was that when you are a trial court judge and you have a two-week motion cycle, every 2 weeks, you'll deal with any number of motions, some of which are opposed, many of which are unopposed. And the burden on the trial court, even though a motion is unopposed, very frequently, you always have to review the motion to understand whether or not the moving party is in fact entitled to that relief. So simply because something is unrebutted does not mean that that moving party should get the relief seeking. And the same principle applies to the appellate division's reasoning in this matter. Trial court did not have unrebutted evidence. It had the testimony of Mr. Klein. It had the cross-examination of Mr. Klein, in which was revealed all the deficiencies in his testimony, and the testimony of Mr. Schmidt, even though he offered a different opinion of value based on value and Kosher as one entity, he still had and was retained and testified to his criticisms of the of Mr. Klein's and plaintiff's expert valuation opinion.
Mr. Reiser, why didn't you take a trial court's invitation to offer an additional expert on remand on the value of KDS and KPS?
Number one, that was, as Mr. Stein said, it was a strategic litigation decision. But more importantly, that we were relying on the testimony at trial that we're relying on today, that Mr. Klein's opinion was deficient. It did not take into account the transfer pricing. It valued an entity, valued two entities based purely on revenue. What it did not value on, what it did not offer an opinion on was the costs associated with that revenue. That there was
ample. So again, if you're citing deficiencies in plaintiff's expert, if that was your position, why did you not present your own expert to testify to the value of these companies? Because your expert, Schmidt, at the original trial, did not testify at all with regard to independent value of KDS and KPS as directed by your client. So you at no point had put forth an expert to provide any valuation of those companies. So all of these criticisms that you are arguing, wouldn't that have been better presented through an expert?
Well, Your Honor, I submit that it was presented through an expert, not on any direct testimony of Mr. Schmidt as to the valuation, but Mr. Schmidt's testimony at trial with regard to the deficiencies in Mr. Klein's report. He offered a number of criticisms, and I can direct Your Honor to the transcript.
But the basis of Mr. Schmidt's testimony at the time was there is no value in these companies. These companies do not have independent value, and that determination was reversed by this court. So, you know, that was the crux of his testimony, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, you know, so now you are asking this court and the court below to take into consideration the expert testimony of an expert whose opinion has been reversed, the basis of his opinion has been reversed by this court, which is the basis of the remand in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully suggest that Mr. Schmidt's criticisms of Mr. Klein's opinion was separate from his view that the entity should be valued as one entity. Again, this is a valuation, Mr. Klein's valuation was presented as looking solely at revenue without analyzing any of the significant costs that Cozier provided. The trial court found, and although this court and the appellate division initially reversed the holding about whether or not KPS could be and KDS could be valued separately, as a matter of fact, there was an interlocking connection between all of these companies that was supported in.
Mr. Reiser, can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why does the trial judge have to accept Schmidt's criticisms? The trial judge had Schmidt, had Klein, accepted Klein, rejected Schmidt. That's what trial courts do. They make findings of fact. They determine which expert is more credible than another expert. Your expert didn't put any valuation on KDS and KPS, and Klein did. And the judge accepted that. And why shouldn't that be accepted by this court?
Well, I think it goes back to the appellate division's reasoning that on page 42 of the decision, the appellate division noted that the trial court judge obviously credited the import of Mr. Schmidt's testimony to some degree because he concluded that KDS and KPS lacked any independent.
Well, look.
Reverse.
We put Judge Cantillo in a very difficult position. But, I mean, because he initially said that there was no value for KDS and KPS, and then we said that there was. And we told him to go back and put a value on that. And now you're criticizing him for doing that. And he explained in his opinion how it looked. But he specifically said, I'm bound by what the Supreme Court and the Appellate Division did. They remanded this to me to put a value on it. And that's precisely what I'm going to do. And now you're criticizing him because he did that, because he did precisely what we told him to do.
Well, am I
mistaken?
Your Honor, we're supporting the appellate division's finding that in issuing the remand decision, the trial court didn't make findings of credibility. He didn't show the work that he reached to. I'd submit just as a matter of propriety that the parties are entitled to know the basis of the report. It can't simply be that a trial court can accept an expert's opinion in light of contradictory testimony, which was credited the first time around, and not come to a conclusion, not to analyze the gross margin rate, the effect of the transfer pricing, the fact that these entities operated, despite the fact that they should be valued independently, that they are interrelated and connected and controlled by George Sipco. That information has to be in the trial court's opinion. And that's why we're supporting the remand that the appellate division clearly found that the trial court had.
Who are the principals of Cogar? Who are the principals of Cogar?
At what time, Your Honor?
Well, at the time that this all happened.
Okay. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but Cogar's been sold as of April of 2020, but at the time.
I'm talking about in the relevant time periods. Who were the principals of Cogar?
The principals were George Sipco and Raz Sipco.
The reason why I ask you this is because you try to separate yourself. Oh, Cogar isn't involved in any of this stuff. You know, we're different from George and Raz, but they're not different. They're one and the same. Are we supposed to be looking at them differently? That Cogar is clean if George and Raz are dirty?
I'd submit this court addressed and the appellate division addressed Cogar's motion, plaintiff's motion to dismiss Cogar's appeal. And I think it's accurate to say that a corporation is a succinct a separate and distinct entity from its shareholders. It can only act through its shareholders. The post-judgment conduct from 2016 on, Cogir did not participate in any of the transfers of funds overseas. That was purely the acts of George and Raz, as the trial court found. Cogir didn't participate in that in any of the post-remand hearings on those transfers. Cogir was the conduit, and Cogir is the entity that is paying and has paid a significant portion of the judgment already to date. And that's why you have to separate them. It is a bit of a unique situation, I'll admit that.
Mr. Reiser, if the appellate division decision were affirmed and the case went back on remand, would you be able to introduce additional evidence evaluation? Would you be able to introduce an expert report in your view?
I don't know that I can answer that question, Your Honor, only because as far as I'm aware, Cogir's assets were sold in April of 2020. There is a pending motion in the trial court returnable this Friday, pursuant to which the special fiscal agent is asking the trial court for leave to dissolve Cogir by filing whatever necessary paperwork with the state of New Jersey. So I don't know that there will be a Cogir to appear in a remand decision.
Do you believe it would be appropriate
on remand for you to do so?
For Cogir? I think it depends on, and if Cogir were to appear somehow, I think it would depend on what the trial court would allow. Again, the appellate division's remand is very broad and allows for the trial court to marshal whatever proofs the trial court might need. And because it's been so long, because it's been 15 years, maybe the trial court can't look at a cold record. Maybe the trial court needs a new expert. I can't say what Cogir would argue, though.
Sounds like they might be arguing for a second bite of the apple from that response.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question, Your Honor.
It sounds like Cogir is preserving its right to argue for a second bite of the apple as to expert valuation.
Again, Your Honor, I don't have the client to make that strategy determination with. It's from an objective standpoint, I would think that an entity in that position would in fact want to make whatever proofs it could. And if it's a legitimate non-frivolous argument, then certainly I would think that would be the position Cogir would take. But again, because I don't have a client to discuss this with, I can't answer the question.
Mr. Reiser, you accept the principle that a marketability discount cannot be used unfairly by the controlling or oppressing shareholders to benefit themselves to the detriment of the minority or oppressed shareholders. You accept that principle, do you not?
I accept that Balsamides found that in an oppression action, if there was oppression, then a marketability discount is applicable. I think Your Honor's question to counsel prior about the marketability discount, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's really not a discount more so, and I believe in Lawson Martin or Balsamides or one of the cases interpreting it, there's some academic discussion that perhaps it's more of a price adjustment to reflect the lack of liquidity.
I know it goes back both ways. That's the reason why I asked Mr. Stein that. But Balsamides suggests that it's an equitable principle. And if it is an equitable principle, it would not seem that your client would be entitled to the benefit of that based upon the multitude of wrongdoings done by George and Ras, which I'm not going to bother to enumerate because it would take a long time to do that.
I understand, Your Honor, but I think the court, in fairness, should make a distinction between the post-judgment conduct, the post-remand judgment conduct, for which George and Ras certainly have been sanctioned repeatedly, make the distinction between that conduct and whatever happened prior to the initial remand.
The prejudgment is pretty bad. Backdating, coercion, and I don't have to tell you.
Sure, and yet, Your Honor, this court has not found that alleged misconduct amounts to oppression. And it could be that there is a remedy less than oppression.
Well, Mr. Reiser, a lot of that conduct became clear after the remand as a result of the accounting that was done. So although some of that activity, that misconduct became clear post remand, that was conduct that occurred well before the remand, after the complaint was filed, the backdating and the transfer of significant assets to Koger from KBS and KPS. So I think it's not necessarily the case that a lot of that information and a lot of that misconduct was considered previously, because the accounting is what really shed light on all the, you know, nonsense, all the misconduct that the parties were engaged in. Is that right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, except I would also make another distinction, and I believe co-counsel will likely make this distinction as well. And as we argued in our cross petitions, from 2009 until 2011, Koger was acting and Koger's shareholders were acting pursuant to a finding that Robert was not a shareholder at that time. And so it's unfair, as they argued, to criticize the conduct when, in fact, as a matter of fact, during that time period, and I realized that he was reinstated, no pro tunc, but while, as a matter of fact, during that time period, Robert was not a shareholder. So I think that the misconduct, if any, that should be viewed in terms of the valuation is really what happened up until the valuation date. And that's up to the trial court on remand to decide whether or not such conduct is sufficient to deny a marketability discount. Because clearly the appellate division was aware of all this conduct when it issued its decision and did not find that a marketability discount was not available to the valuation. It just said, you have to go back and show your work.
Mr. Reiser, your position as the company was that the other two entities were not valuable because they were basically estate planning entities. And your expert declined twice to participate in the valuation process. Independent of everything that the other members of the court have said, is that trial strategy, shouldn't that preclude you now from taking a position that you're entitled to some valuation? Aren't you judicially stopped from now seeking an option that was offered to you more than once and you decided as a matter of trial strategy not to adopt?
Again, Your Honor, I would say two things. Number one, I don't know what the position of Koger will be if it's in fact an existing entity at the time of a remand. Number two, the important thing I don't think is what Koger's position is, but whether or not the trial court wants to hear a valuation from Koger or from RazCIPCO, because that opinion was not offered on the first remand. I don't know that would necessarily be stopped from asserting that position. But again, I think it's for the trial court to determine what the trial court wants and needs to hear in order to marshal all of the appropriate and relevant evidence.
Is there a difference then between the trial court directing Koger to provide information and Koger itself seeking this time, as opposed to its strategic decision last time, to present that type of evidence?
Yes, I would think so, Your Honor. If the trial court, which again was given broad latitude on this remand, if the trial court wants to hear an explanation from Koger or from Raz, maybe the trial court will review the transcripts and determine that, yes, there is a problem here with the plaintiff's valuation opinion and it needs to be addressed. And I need to hear from an expert to tell me why plaintiff's valuation shouldn't survive.
So again, short of that,
could Koger itself come forward and say, Judge, we want to present an expert on valuation. We know we didn't do it before. We want to do so now.
Absolutely. It would be up to the trial court to decide yes or no, whether the trial court wants to hear another valuation opinion.
So how many bites at the apple does your client get, or non-client? Sometimes I notice you speak on behalf of Koger. Sometimes you don't know if they exist and you don't represent them. But assuming for the purpose of my question, how many bites at the apple would that be with this valuation?
Your Honor, it would be another attempt to prove its valuation case. I agree.
But you rejected it the first time. So you're now getting a separate bite at the apple after you rejected that before.
Your Honor, I think the important thing here is that it's the trial court, according to the appellate division, and as we would support, the trial court did not get the valuation correct, really the second time. The first time it found that in 2009, it found that plaintiff wasn't even entitled to a remedy. So it's really, I don't think it's a third bite of the apple. I think it's perhaps a second bite of the apple if Cozier were to come forward on remand and request the ability to show the trial court another view.
I have to correct something for myself, something I clearly didn't understand. Well, maybe two things now. You mentioned that the conduct of Raz and George, really the relevant time period between 2009 and 2011, is not conduct that is relevant to shareholder oppression because Robert was not a shareholder during that time period. Did you say that?
You know, that was the position that we took when we, when Cozier submitted its cross petition for certification. And I believe it's the position that Raz Sipko took during his cross petition for certification.
The answer to my question, therefore, is yes, that is what you're suggesting.
Yes.
Notwithstanding the fact that the trial court essentially reversed that claim, found that claim was not valid, and reinstated Robert's shares, even though it said, I can't value it, I don't give them a value, it said that is an unconditional gift, there's no consideration. It's Robert was a shareholder. You're wrong. Between 2009 and 2011, he was entitled to those shares and that position. That was affirmed by the appellate division. That's not changed. So that argument is bogus. Is it not?
Maybe I should clarify that. The position that was taken, and again, Mr.
I'm not asking what was taken. I'm asking what is the position now? Clearly, every court has found that the conduct of Raz and George between 2009 and 2011 is relevant on the issue of shareholder oppression because Robert was, in fact, according to the court, notwithstanding your contentions, was a shareholder. He never should have been divested, could be divested of those shares. Isn't that right?
That is correct. That was the holding of the appellate division, and it was affirmed by this court. The point I was just trying to make, and perhaps I didn't make it clearly enough, but in that period of time, in 2009 to 2011, George and Raz were acting as if they did not have a third shareholder relevant to those entities.
And somehow you're arguing that is pertinent to your argument, even though the trial court appellate division, every court that's considered it said the way that George divested Robert of his interest was wrong, that his conduct's been wrong all the way along. That's still your position.
I'm not attempting to say that the appellate division and Supreme Court were wrong in reinstating Robert as of the date of, you know, as if he was never divested of his interests. I'm just saying that for the remand decision, the trial court went past the valuation date and made determinations that conduct bared on the valuation of Cozier as of 2007.
I understand. And it did so because, according to the court, that was a period of time that Robert was, in fact, a shareholder who, from my question would be, could be somehow affected because George never had the right to divest him of his shares. And that's the only point I'm trying to make. Correct? You know,
there's a tension there because the valuation date was undisputed. It has never been changed. And that's the issue with that part of this matter is that you have conduct pre-2007. And no one has changed the valuation date since the case began. So is it the valuation date was wrong? No party has argued that the valuation date was incorrect. So even if this conduct was inappropriate, it happened after 2007. That should be taken into account.
Okay.
Other questions for Mr. Reiser? Anyone? You fielded some questions today from the court about misconduct by George and Ross, and I just want to make clear for the record that there's a distinction to be drawn between counsel, counsel here today, whose conduct has not been questioned, and the conduct of clients and principals of the clients, and that's clear to the court. Thank you, Mr. Reiser. Thank you. We'll hear next from Mr. LaSalle.
Hi, Horne, if your honor would indulge me, I'm going to stand and address the court.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. The appellate division in 8 concise pages set forth the issue, the facts, and the law on this petition, and no amount of hyperbole, vitriol, or the passage of time can alter the principle that the appellate division ruled on and applied in a per curiam opinion. A decision that was rendered looking through the prism of a selected valuation date of November 2007 and events that took place both before and after that date. The appellate division affirmed the trial court's decision regarding the defendant's liability for a buyout in the two New Jersey corporations, KPS and KDS. But again, within those 8 pages of the opinion, reversed the decision as to the amount of the judgment. The appellate division then remanded the matter to the trial court for a new value determination, which brings all of us here today. We would assert to the court that it would contravene fairness and New Jersey law to allow Robert to receive a windfall by affirming the valuation that erroneously failed to properly assess the fair value of KPS and KDS. This, however, is exactly what he is asking this court to do. Specifically, it would be manifestly unfair and improper to enforce a flawed judgment against RAS, which defies economic reality. It was the opinion of Robert's expert that a hypothetical investor or purchaser would pay $18 million for 50% of companies that had none of their own products, no infrastructure to provide contractually required customer support, an absent and completely non-participating 50% shareholder, which was entirely reliant on a third company for future licensing, and was at the mercy of that third company for the pricing charge for support and infrastructure. Indeed, the conclusion that a hypothetical purchaser would ever pay $18 million for 50% of such a company is contradicted by the record that was before the trial court, which included several of the following factors. George controlled Coger, the third company, and exercised de facto control over both KPS and KDS. The family practice, and these were indeed family businesses, was that George controlled the income flow to the brothers that would form the revenue for the two companies. Both KPS and KDS were dependent upon assets, including technology, informally licensed from Coger, which was controlled again by George. KPS and KDS had no employees other than Robert and Raz and had no infrastructure. According to the trial court, KDS and KPS could only have been the successes they were because of the value provided to them by Coger and Coger alone. In 2006, Robert voluntarily left the Coger companies, surrendered his shares in the companies, and moved to California. Robert did so because he understood that his interests in KPS and KDS had no ascertainable value, and he predicted, sadly, properly, that the companies would not survive his departure. After Robert voluntarily surrendered his shares, Raz was left alone to run the companies, to shoulder all the responsibilities, to shoulder any economic hardships that would come with it, and figure out how to provide the required support for the licenses if that was possible under the new structure. After the trial court ruled in Raz's favor in 2009 and found that Robert was no longer a shareholder, Robert did not seek a stay of that ruling and instead allowed the ruling to remain in force in effect without any attempted intervention by the Chancery or any other court, with a determination that he was not a shareholder, not involved in management, and not involved in any business judgment decisions. Robert has never explained how Raz was supposed to consider his economic interests after his voluntary departure to California in 2006, and indeed before the appellate division decision reversed the trial court in May of 2011. Also in the record, it was Robert falsely representing to the trial court that KPS and KDS possessed a product called Enterprise Software. Robert's expert provided a valuation without reviewing any of the licensing agreements. Robert misrepresented to his expert and caused his expert to believe that KPS and KDS owned the piece of the technology that was really Coger's. Robert's expert never reviewed George Sitko or Robert Sitko's deposition testimony before offering his expert opinion. Robert's expert conceded that the companies really operated as one entity and felt it was necessary to look at the combined entity to really capture all the expenses and what's going on and look at what the profitability of the entity was as a whole. A very important concept, because that's exactly what Mr. Schmidt did. And what he felt compelled to do was to value the companies as a whole. According to the court's prior opinion, in 2006, KPS and KDS had net income of approximately $1,100,000 together. In 2007, KPS had net income, that's 2 years after Robert voluntarily left and never came back, of $246,000. Can this logically support a $36 million price tag? Robert's expert also attributed a fictitious 75.1% net income percentage to the companies using what he referred to as normalization adjustments, which ignored the economic reality that George and Coger controlled the infrastructure pricing that was charged to KPS and KDS. In fact, Robert's expert testified that he did not know what expenses KPS and KDS incurred to generate their revenue, again, which flowed entirely from Coger. In response to one of the trial court's questions, Robert's expert conceded that, in his opinion, a purchaser of these entities would probably buy everything, meaning that they would have to buy Coger, KPS, and KDS, and not just KPS.
Mr. LaSala.
Yes, you are.
Are you arguing before us that KPS and KDS don't have independent value? Because if so, that determination was already made in 2013. It sounds like a lot of the arguments you're making sounds like arguments that should have been presented through an expert on remand. I'm going to ask you the same question. Why did you not present an expert on remand? Because a lot of the arguments you're making right now sounds like something that the trial court could have digested through an expert.
Well, what they are really, Your Honor, are factors and items from the record before Judge Cantillo that, according to the appellate division opinion, should have been part of his reasoned and fair analyses coming up with a valuation number. But our answer would be similar, very similar to what Mr. Reiser said. Our expert was unable to separate out KPS and KDS because of the unique idiosyncratic relationship between the companies and how they were structured, and how the revenue stream was generated, and how the revenue stream flowed, and how it could be affected going into the future.
But we're beyond that.
After this, right.
We're beyond that. I mean, this court has said that these two companies can be independently valued. So I don't understand why we're returning to arguments that have long since been disposed of.
Well, we're returning there, Justice, because this is the appellate division has directed, based on its review of the record and as part of its lengthy, for I don't know how many page opinion, that what in the juxtaposition of this case, in the juxtaposition of implicitly rejecting the argument of Mr. Klein, and then explicitly accepting it to the tune of $24 million without any further analysis, without any further consideration, without looking at the infrastructure, without looking at the goodwill, without looking at the support of Coger, is something that is contrary to the law in Balsamitas and Lawson and generally established principles in the state of New Jersey.
But you are arguing to us, if I'm hearing you correctly, that these two companies have no value. When we said they do have value, and we sent it back to Judge Cantillo to put a value on it, which is precisely what he did. Now, he accepted an expert that you don't like, but that's what he did.
It's not a matter of not liking it, Your Honor, and it's a matter of analyzing and dealing with the appellate division opinion. What Judge Cantillo did was accept an expert report or an expert valuation that he had implicitly rejected because of its not finding that it was a value.
He did what we told him to do. You cannot fault Judge Cantillo for doing what we told him to do. He originally said it didn't have a value. We went back and told him to put a value on it, that it does have a value. That's what he did. And now you're faulting him for doing precisely what we asked him to do.
No one has a higher regard for Judge Cantillo than I do, Justice. But what you said, you sent the case back to come up with a remedy, if any. The remedy could have been the value was zero. The remedy could have been the value was zero. And not having a proper value, using the proper methods and the proper methods and determination at the end of the day, adversely affects in a very dramatic way our client, because our client is still subject to enforcement proceedings. Our client has given up his shares in KPS and KDS to satisfy the judgment. So these are very real things that could be impacted by Judge Cantillo, by the now trial court, going back and looking at all of the factors that the appellate division suggested they do. And they lay them all right out in a sentence, in a very short order, following saying that the ability to get a new expert was rebuffed. The court goes on to say that Judge Cantillo still should have done X, Y, Z. And that's the point. The point is that the trial court, in this case, the Chancery Court, in a closely held corporate case involving valuations, has a wide range of discretions available to it. One is accept an expert report. One is reject an expert report. One is have a modification. One is throw them all out. Well, even right. In Torres, where there was only one expert.
You're right. You're right. He had an expert report. He could accept it. He could reject it. He could have taken part of it and rejected part of it. He accepted all of it while giving your client the opportunity of presenting another expert to put its own value on it, which you decided not to do.
Well, our client wasn't mute on the point, Your Honor. Our client and Mr. Schmidt went through the process of detailing a number of criticisms of Mr. Klein's report. There is no reference whatsoever to Judge Cantillo looking at one of them. Our expert found the 35% marketability discount rate on the enterprise as a whole, the way that Klein suggested he could do it before he backed out the numbers, that wasn't discussed by Judge Cantillo. No discount.
Again, Mr. LaSalle, as you just said yourself, the trial judge had wide discretion here, and he exercised his discretion to accept Mr. Klein's expert testimony and not accept the criticisms of your expert from, you know, the previous trial. You said it yourself. There is wide discretion here, and he exercised the discretion in a manner that is not favorable to your client.
No, the point that I was trying to make, Justice, is that's the end of the day. The point is, how's the proper way to get to the end of the day, to get to the exercise of your discretion, to get to the valuation that's the fair, equitable, reasoned, the court used the language over and over again, the reasoned, just, and factually supported conclusion by evaluating the opinions and credibility, which is why the entire universe of the case is important. There may have been rulings that affected that, but those are the type of things that Judge Cantillo should have looked at in going from an implicitly rejected to an explicitly accepted as a whole without any consideration. That's the point. That's exactly what the de novo discretion, that's exactly what the court was supposed to do under the principles.
Mr. LaSalle, I gather from your argument, it's consistent with what Mr. Reiser said, is simply that the trial court's findings are not supported by the record. Period.
That's obviously has to be a part of our argument, Your Honor. But the real juxtaposition of the argument is that Judge Cantillo, in following this court's instruction to provide a remedy if any, in providing that remedy failed to comply with New Jersey law, because he switched from an implicitly rejected valuation, which was basically over to one that was there.
It's unsupported by the record and it's inconsistent with New Jersey law.
Correct.
Okay, correct. I got you.
To continue, imposing such a flawed valuation against RAS is even more unfair, again, when coupled with the circumstances that led the trial court to hold the buyout of Robert's shares was required. The appellate division held that after the trial court found that a shareholder voluntarily surrendered his shares in a closely held New Jersey corporation and was no longer a shareholder, the remaining shareholder was still required to consider the economic interests of the voluntarily departed shareholder in making business decisions regarding the corporations. In this instance,
yeah, can I ask you a question about this voluntary? You keep on repeating voluntarily departed. What does that mean? I mean,
that means he got.
We found that he did not relinquish his interests, and the record suggests the reason why he didn't relinquish the interests. No consideration and coercion. What is this voluntarily walked away? I'm trying to figure that out.
Judge Cantillo, right up until the last of his opinions, found, based on the testimony before him, that Robert made a determination because of family disharmony to leave. He left. He left and left the corporations behind with his statement that you're never going to make it. And he was right. But that's what he did. He left. And I don't think there could be any dispute in the record that from the point he quote unquote left up until maybe never, he was not involved in a single business decision, was not involved in any decisions concerning debt or any way to handle the revenue stream. That's what I mean by that, Justice. To continue. So in effect, what Robert is now asking this court to enforce, which has been ruled upon to be an erroneous valuation against RAS. When presented with the valuation the first time, again, the trial court rejected it, and then now finds that it's both coherent and convincing without any of the detailed analysis that is required. Now, I think it's important to, and I know the court has read the opinion, and I know the court has read the critical 8 pages, but just to highlight some of the language from the appellate division opinion. For example, the critical finding was that by simply accepting the opinion of Robert's expert, which the trial court implicitly rejected at trial without any considered explanation for acceptance on remand, the judge failed to reach a reasoned, just, and factually supported conclusion by weighing and evaluating the expert's opinions, including their credibility. Again, I know the horse is dead, but that is precisely what Judge Cantillo did not do, what the appellate division has criticized him for doing, and what the appellate division wants corrected.
Can I ask you a question? Judge Cantillo said he found it was coherent and convincing. Like, what more do you expect of him? Do you want him to repeat over what was in the expert report?
Your Honor, again, he implicitly rejected Klein's opinion when he wrote his initial decision. When it comes to the point of flipping that and rendering a different opinion, he does it with using two words. His opinion is coherent and convincing, period. That's it. There is the juxtaposition of the argument right there. Coherent and convincing. Why? Why did it suddenly become coherent and convincing? What proofs did you marshal? What financial information did you look at? What IRS regulations did you take a look at? All of those things are absent and they're still absent today. That's the point. So the limited remand is to address all of that to make sure that at the end of the day, all of the factors are considered, including the appropriate discounts, or I would call them adjustments, along the lines that you were asking earlier, Justice Al. That's the point. And again, the appellate division did not do this, did not order the remand without instructions. It's very specific and very clear about what it wanted cleared up when it stated that The court on remand is to consider all sources of information that affect the fairness and equity of Robert's expert suggested buyout price, including defendant's criticism, the idiosyncratic relationship between Coger, KDS, and KPS, and its effect on valuation under all the circumstances of the case. So not only is it reversed, not only is it remanded, but there were specific instructions given as to some of the things that the trial court will have to look at to make sure that at the end of the day, this opinion is accepted as coherent and convincing without any explanation is the right one, the wrong one, or someplace in between. Yes, Justice Holland. Oh, I'm sorry, I saw your light go on, I'm sorry. And just to address briefly, I know I'm running out of time. The whole question about unrebutted. Robert contends that the trial court was required to accept the unrebutted valuation of his expert. He makes this assertion, even though, again, the judgment found that the trial court wrongfully failed to consider the numerous criticisms and the application of at least a discount for marketability. Again, we would say and submit to the court that the law is clear that a trial court is not required to accept the valuation report of either expert. And rather, the court must ascertain the fair market value for the stock for which there is no market. Just a couple of quick points, if I might. In addition to his original report, which he called preliminary, Klein has put in two supplemental reports. In those two supplemental reports, he didn't provide any opinions regarding the license or supplemental opinions regarding the license. Robert could have also supplemented his expert report to fill in the gaps, the many gaps that had been found by the appellate division to exist in his earlier report. He did not do so. And then even the oppression statute under which Brass, Coger, and George were originally sued allows adjustments in order to get to fair value. Adjustments up, adjustments down to get to fair value, following an analysis, a complete analysis of all of the relevant factors and the marshaling of additional proof if necessary. With that, I would, if the court has no further questions, I
would. Thank you, Mr. LaSalle. Mr. Stein, did you want to offer a brief rebuttal? You need to unmute yourself.
I'm tempted to say nothing. I'll be very, very brief. I feel like I'm in a time warp back to 2008 all over again. That could have been the closing argument, as if nothing's happened between now and then. When Mr. LaSalle says his expert applied a 35% marketability discount, he neglects to mention that Judge Cantillo actually considered it and actually struck that testimony from the record because the only support was advice of instructions from counsel at deposition. Mr. Schmidt, who's not from New Jersey, had never heard of Balsamides, had never heard of Lawson. Mr. LaSalle says that his expert, Schmidt, was unable to separate KP and KD at trial and to independently value them, putting aside that this court in 2013 said, yes, you can. At trial, in testimony, Mr. Schmidt acknowledged that he could have independently valued those companies, but he was instructed not to. I don't understand fully the significance of the period of time 2009 to 2011 as if the procedural posture of the case should forgive wrongdoing during that time period, but it's a red herring if it makes sense to anyone, because what Judge Cantillo found on remand, none of which was undisturbed by the appellate division, is that the wrongful conduct, the backdating, the diversion of revenue began in 2007 when the complaint was filed, continued while we were litigating down before Judge Cantillo during the trial, through the appeal process, after Robert was reinstated as an owner of KP and KD, and of course, the efforts to deprive Robert of the fair value of his equitable interest continues to this day. We were once in a mediation, and Judge Karchman described this dispute as biblical, you know, the nature of the family dispute. And it is tragic at bottom, something I never forget, twin brothers and a father. But twin brother and father made a decision. They'd rather burn the whole thing down than give a dime to Robert. And that's why 15 years into it, we're still litigating. It's time to put an end to this. It's time to put an end to it now. I just would refer the court to pages 18 and 19 of our original petition, which lays out Judge Contillo's explanation, coherent explanation of what had changed between 2008 and his remand decision and how that affected the way he viewed testimony at trial. And I have nothing further to add. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stein, and thank you to counsel.